Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. If concerns over homeland security or your latest internet purchase keep you awake at night, you may soon rest easy. And you can say thanks to quantum physics for that. ICOR and General Dynamics Canada have joined forces to support research into the development of quantum distribution keys, and the end result could revolutionize the whole field of cryptography. And Dr. Robert Williams from the University of Lethbridge has just received the largest grant ever to study social and economic impacts of gambling. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. When I was a kid, my friends and I would send secret messages to one another using tricks like invisible ink or a backwards alphabet. Little did we know we were engaging in cryptography, albeit a very simple form of coding messages to keep our secrets. Today, cryptography and secure communications are extremely important. They touch our lives in everything from military defense to credit card purchases over the internet. Thanks to ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta has a lot to contribute in this area. And ICOR, along with General Dynamics Canada, has just launched a new research chair at the University of Calgary, this one focused on the use of quantum physics in cryptography. Dr. Randy Gable is the president and CEO of ICOR.
Each new chair launch seems to be unique. What's unique about this one is a further investment in quantum information science at the University of Calgary, coupled with a new relationship with General Dynamics, who's interested in the applications of quantum key distribution, and the recruiting of one of the stellar Europeans doing work in this area to Canada. So those three things together make this one rather unique.
What will Dr. Tittle be doing?
We'll be doing two things. One is he will be working with graduate students and other faculty at the University of Calgary to augment the labs already started by the Institute for Quantum Information, including some relatively unique ways of experimenting with photonics and entanglement at the quantum level. As well, he'll be working on specific problems with General Dynamics, which have to do with creating reliable quantum key distribution, that is, sharing decoding keys with the world in a way that if they're touched, you know, and you don't use them. So he's doing that in a practical way, including SAIT because of their connection with this long fiber outlet. So he'll be basically training, educating people inside the university and building this bridge to commercial activities outside.
How is this going to be any different than what we have now in terms of security of sending information?
An important thing to note is that we have relatively secure systems these days based on conventional computation and the probability that there isn't enough computation to break sophisticated keys. When I send you a message and I send you the method for decoding it, that key, we're relatively certain that the key can't be broken. What we can't tell with that key is whether anybody has tried to break it. The key, so to speak, in quantum key distribution is that I create a decoding key which cannot be corrupted. If anybody touches it or tries to look at it, it's immediately changed, and we know we shouldn't be using it for decoding. So we get completely reliable encoding and decoding, and that will be a great step forward.
Or a quantum leap.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Randy.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Randy Gable, President and CEO of ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence. The other partner in this new research chair is General Dynamics Canada, a company long associated with the defense industry. Mark Adcock is a chief scientist with General Dynamics Canada.
Information security in a fully networked world is what our customers are looking for. They are looking for being able to bring information from many different areas in order to command and control what they term, say, for example, homeland security. When you have that problem, you tend to have a need for what we call multiple levels of security. You need, and this really creates a lot of physical overhead on the operators that they don't want to see. They don't want to have to work with all of this overhead. So we're looking for innovative technologies to help simplify that problem. One of those innovative technologies is quantum key distribution, hence our interest in Wolfgang's research.
Now, how does that make it different from the ordinary way of doing things?
Well, historically, cryptography has always been associated with the need for two trusting parties to exchange keys so that they can communicate securely. Before the advent of modern electronics, this was often done by things like the two parties exchanging a piece of paper with a key written in it, or in modern days with a James Bond type thing with a briefcase handcuffed to somebody's wrist as that information is shared. There's an old adage, in order to communicate securely, you must first communicate securely. Modern day electronics attempted to solve that in the 1980s by generating a thing called asymmetric cryptography or public key infrastructure based cryptography. The problem with that cryptography, it's not known how secure it is. This has a wonderful ability to sort of blend those two things together. You can get back to the old, really secure way, but you don't have the encumbrance of that physical key exchange because you're doing it optically. And the optical key exchange, you can tell when you got eavesdropped on.
How would this be used in a military or a defense way?
Well, what we would envision is a future centralized command station where commanders or people are looking after the needs of the country need to take feeds from all over the country. And those may be RCMP in a certain region. They may be metropolitan police forces in another. There may be fisheries and oceans vehicles out on either coast. There may be aircraft flying around, or there may be deployed infantry somewhere else. And the information that is being given to one of those groups maybe have to be kept secret from the other groups. And mixing them together creates a lot of challenges. And this multiple levels of security is a very complex challenge. And part of the problem is to still make it operationally effective and easy to use despite its complexity. So what we're looking for is any technologies that can make it easier to use. We see this as one of those technologies amongst about 10 or 15 very important technologies that need to be integrated together. And that's our value added. We understand the technologies and how they can be put together to make this system deliver a capability that is greater than the sum of its parts.
Will this ever trickle down into the general public, general consumer?
I think that there is a chance. I think the very first actual implementations of it will be done by governments with deep pockets. I think that as that happens, we will see the needs for things like policies. Governments will need to have policies written about this, where and how it can be deployed. And as that goes along, you'll see more and more innovation on the edge because of its ability to be useful in real-life manners. Then you'll see it start to think. And these things can tend to sort of almost have a snowball effect, and they're very difficult to predict. But I would say that there is a reasonable chance, especially if we start to make advances in the area of quantum computing.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You're welcome.
That was Mark Adcock, Chief Scientist of the Command, Control, and Communications Intelligence Sensors and Reconnaissance Division of General Dynamics Canada. He's based in Calgary. The man who will hold the new ICOR General Dynamics Canada Industry Research Chair in Quantum Cryptography and Communications is Dr. Wolfgang Tittle. Wolfgang comes to the University of Calgary from Geneva, Switzerland. I asked him what quantum cryptography really means.
What does it mean? I can tell you what it does or what we will do with it. And quantum cryptography is a possibility to send information in an absolutely secure way. In order to appreciate the importance of that, we have to realize that our daily life is determined by the use of email, by the use of banking machines, by doing our shopping over the internet, sending medical records, all things where we send private information over channels that can easily be listened into, and we want to have this private information to be perfectly protected. And quantum cryptography is a way to protect it with absolute secrecy, which is fundamentally different from any way it is done nowadays.
Well, how would it actually differ from the way it's done now? You talked a little bit about the problems with amplification.
How it differs is, let's put it like this. If we want to encode some information that we then send over to our partner, we need a key to lock the information, and then we need a key to unlock the information. The problem is, how do we distribute a key? Now, we can do this by trusted carriers, but we can only trust or hope that this carrier was indeed trustworthy, but we can never see if indeed he was trustworthy, if indeed the key has arrived without anybody having had a look at it, without anybody knowing about the key. If we use a quantum key, there is a principle law in quantum information, or in quantum physics, that we cannot copy a quantum key without changing it. So if somebody would have a look at our key, it would change its form, which is very easy to verify. So if our partner gets a corrupted key, he would see that, and he would not use this key in order to secure his message. Only if he would see that the key has not been corrupted, that means that nobody would have copied the key, that nobody knows anything about the key. Only if this is the case, he would use this key to encode his information, and then the encoding is in a perfectly secure way.
Is distance a problem in sending the messages?
Distance will become a problem in sending these quantum keys. What we need in order to encode a quantum key is quantum particles, and we use single photons for this. So these are tiny light particles, and we send them over the standard telecommunication network, but they will get lost after some time, let's say 50 kilometers. And then the quantum key that is encoded onto these light particles will, of course, get lost as well. So that sets an upper limit, an upper distance, to the possibility to distribute a quantum key by sending photons. But there are other ways to do it, and these ways are based on sending only the information about the key without sending a carrier of the key. And this is something we term quantum teleportation. So this is something where I have a key here, and I can teleport the information about this quantum key over to you without actually sending a particle that carries this key. And this promises much longer distances than those that can be achieved with technology that is nowadays being commercialized.
What then is the part that you play in all of this?
There is a couple of parts. In the first set of experiments and the first part of my research, we will send quantum keys over a couple of 10 kilometers based on encoding into single photons. And the idea here, our goal, is to bring it all the way down from concepts to the marketplace by benefiting from expertise at the University of Calgary, at SAIT, and in particular at GDC, General Dynamics Canada. In the second step, we will extend these key distribution protocols, or these key distribution apparatus, to networks, because we want to make them widely available. Everybody should benefit from it. And then the third one, we will extend the distance. So this requires research into quantum teleportation, and it also requires research into quantum memory. We need to store keys for a long time, but if they're encoded onto photons, they would travel with the speed of light, and this is pretty difficult to store.
What is entanglement?
Entanglement is one of those quantum concepts that are very difficult to understand. Entanglement is something like having two coins that are very far apart, and if I toss these two coins, they will always fall on the same side. Either always fall on head or always fall on tail. In a classical world, this is something that doesn't exist. These two coins would either fall on heads or on tail, but there's no reason to expect that both would react in the same way. If you would have quantum coins, we would actually observe this perfect correlation.
And how do you use it then?
This perfect correlation can be used in order to establish perfect correlated keys. So this is one of the links to quantum key distribution. The second thing is that these perfect correlations is exactly what we need in order to teleport quantum information from one point to another. We need quantum entangled particles in order to do this.
Thank you very much, Wolfgang.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Dr. Wolfgang Tittle, Associate Professor of Physics at the University of Calgary. He holds the new ICOR General Dynamics Canada Industry Research Chair in Quantum Cryptography and Communications. I also spoke with Dr. Randy Gable and Mark Adcock. Building casinos is the latest development push in many of Alberta's larger communities. But in Ontario, there's a moratorium on casinos. People there are very concerned about the impact of problem gambling. Sociologist Dr. Rob Williams of the University of Lethbridge has just started a huge study around the very last gambling joint to be built in Ontario.
Well, this is a $3.1 million grant. It's the largest gambling research grant ever given. And it's a study of the social and economic impacts of gambling in a particular area of Ontario. Now, in addition to looking at social and economic impacts, because there's a racino, a slot, slot machines going into a racetrack, in addition to doing a before and after comparison of the impacts of the racino, We're doing a five-year longitudinal study of 4,000 people to see what sort of things cause people to gamble in the first place and gamble socially versus gamble irresponsibly. What sort of traits cause people to become problem gamblers and not.
So why Ontario?
Well, two reasons. One is that this is the last gambling venue slated for Ontario. There was a moratorium put on all future casino and racino developments in Ontario 2 years ago. This commitment for this particular racetrack was given prior to that moratorium. So this is the very last opportunity to do a before and after impact study in that province. And I guess the second reason is that Ontario has a dedicated gambling research organization, the Ontario Problem Gambling Research Center, who can fund such things.
Now, why did Ontario put in that moratorium?
Well, I'll take some credit for that in that there was a lot of publicity 2 years ago around some work myself and Rob Wood did concerning what proportion of revenue does the Ontario government and all provincial governments make from problem gamblers. That our contention is the purpose of government largely should be to serve the people. And if you can determine that a good portion of revenue from whatever, in this case gambling, comes from vulnerable people, then that would seem to be contrary to the purposes of government and suggest that it's not an operation government should be in. So after a fair bit of research, Dr. Wood and I determined that roughly 35% of gaming revenue in Ontario actually comes from problem gamblers. And I think that might have been the straw that broke the camel's back. There had been some other negative publicity about the increasing rates of problem gambling in that province, but I think that was perhaps the precipitator for this moratorium.
Now, the study that you actually are doing in Ontario at the Racino, how are you going about that?
It opens this summer, so we've been mobilizing rather quickly to do a very comprehensive baseline assessment of the community in terms of collecting all the economic data, social data, you know, employment rates, welfare rates, crime rates, problem gambling prevalence rates, attitudes towards gambling, all sorts of things. No stones being left unturned here. In addition to gathering generic statistical, economic, and social data, we're in the midst of recruiting 4,000 people from that general area, a random sample of people from the Quinte, Belleville area, both to establish their current levels of gambling behavior, as well as assessing all aspects of their being, their intellect, their personality, mental health problems, substance use, their recreational leisure time, their income, all sorts of demographics. So we have a good representative sample of a large portion of the populace, and then we're going to be tracking them, reassessing them every 9 months. So we'll have one more assessment before the Racino opens, and then 4 or 5 after it opens, and to see what sort of changes occur in that cohort of individuals, in addition to the generic statistical data we'll get from Stats Canada and other government and non-government agencies during those time periods.
Now, do you have any thoughts at this point as to what you think you're going to find?
There have been other studies. I think you probably interviewed me on, we had a conference on the social and economic impacts of gambling with the Alberta Gaming Research Institute last March. And what that conference did was to get together most of the primary people in the world who have investigated this issue. So there's been a fair bit of prior research on the social and economic impacts of gambling. But what was very evident from that research is most of it is seriously flawed. This is a considerably more complex question than almost any other in gambling, and it's a considerably more complex economic analysis than is typical, in that the social costs of gambling are very much intertwined with the economic costs and benefits. You can't really separate those out. Furthermore, it's the social costs and benefits are very much more difficult to quantify, are very much more wide-ranging, and very difficult to combine in any meaningful way with the economic costs. So long-winded answer to your question, we're not sure. We do know, and part of the reason we got the funding was we do know we are using the absolute optimal methodology that has evolved from all the prior mistakes. There have been several socioeconomic studies, but they've all been inadequate because of insensitivity to the issues that I just identified. So what we know for sure is we're using state-of-the-art methodology with very generous resources to ensure that it gets operationalized to determine unambiguously, at least for this region, what the true economic and social costs and benefits are.
Why do you think that our society has moved so much towards having casinos and bingos and horse racing, where gambling has become so big a part of our economic and social life?
I'm not really sure I know the answer to that. I do know, just looking at the history of gambling, it's always been that way. We go in these sort of 100-year cycles that right now we're sort of at the apex of the latest cycle where virtually every form of gambling is available and legal. That also used to be the case about 100 years ago. And typically what happens, because gambling's always been with us for thousands and thousands of years, but it's never been quite accepted. And typically what happens is that it gradually starts creeping in, as it did in Canada in the last 50 years, starting with, well, okay, let's have charity bingos, and that's not so problematic. So let's try a lottery, and that's not so problematic. Well, and it keeps on expanding incrementally, and now it's basically everything goes. But when you reach that apex, people start being more worried about the social consequences, and governments start getting leery about what they've got into, and you know, there's some retrenchment and, you know, things like calling it gaming as opposed to its true nature of gambling, and a lot of efforts being put into problem gambling prevention and responsible gambling features, so-called, on VLTs and slot machines. It's evidence of the attempt to try and mitigate some of the social harms that always come with gambling. And I expect this cycle will follow all prior cycles in that at some point, and you see this in a few jurisdictions in the world right now, they start banning or restricting gambling. So South Carolina has gotten rid of all its gambling machine slots and VLTs. North Carolina is doing the same. Portugal, Latvia, Norway are doing it imminently. And so you're starting to see the tip of this reevaluation and perhaps restriction. So it's just, I think human nature, it's gambling is something a lot of people like, but when it's unrestricted, you inevitably have problems, and then, you know, there's no happy medium. We either go whole hog or we ban it all together, and it's that sort of cyclical thing that's been happening.
Thank you very much, Rob.
You're welcome, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Robert Williams, a professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge. He's also a coordinator with the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Advanced Education and Technology, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.